In its 73-year history, the Tony Awards have never been canceled. That is, until last year. In the wake of a terrible pandemic, Broadway and theaters across the country shut their doors, and the Tony Awards were postponed indefinitely. There have certainly been labor disputes and lockouts in the past, and there was 9/11, of course, and other events that have affected the Broadway season itself, but never had the Tonys been put on hold. Even in years where they weren't broadcast on television or radio, they were still held in person. So after more than 2 years since the last Tonys were presented, the awards will finally take place later this month to honor the 2019-2020 season. And for the next 3 episodes, I'll be talking with 2 Broadway actors and a music director about their careers in New York and their own thoughts on the Tonys. I start today with actor and singer Will Swenson. Now, he's someone I've known for more than 20 years and was a Tony nominee for his outstanding work in the revival of the musical Hair back in 2009. But even still, he has some very strong opinions about the Tony Awards.
I have this mental block with the awards stuff. Like, I hate it. I hate it so much. The minute that, like, a show is successful, it just gets in your head, and it's like this other entity in the room that, for my money, I just do not like.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, one of Feedspot's top 25 theater podcasts. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, and each week I explore the realities of what it really means to make it in the performing arts. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can show your support and help me further the mission and reach of this podcast. For as little as $5 a month, you'll get special bonus episodes available only to podcast supporters. Learn about all that and more at whyillnevermakeit.com or click on the link in the show notes. No matter where we are in our career, or what level or status we've achieved, there's always someone just ahead of us that we may either idolize or even be jealous of. They are getting the roles or the shows that we want to be in. They have a certain level of fame and accolades that we would like to experience. Now, often these are people outside of our social or family circles who have simply been down different paths from us and found different outcomes. Now, I talk to a lot of those people here on the podcast. But today I'm talking with Will Swenson, someone that I've known since the late 90s when he and I were working at Disney World in Orlando, both sharing the role of Gaston in Beauty and the Beast. We are both baritone leading men who grew up in the church and both had first marriages that didn't last. We have shared so much in common, really. So one of my initial reasons for wanting to talk to him was to figure out what I could have done differently. What are the 1 or 2 things I could have done that would have let me mirror his path, his career? But instead, what I came away with was a greater understanding of shared experience, of commonalities we all have, both professional and personal, that go far deeper than who is better than who or who has a better life or career. Now, there's a lot to digest here, so I decided to split up our conversation into 2 parts. In this episode, you're basically getting an intimate conversation between old friends, celebrating the big moments and successes like his Broadway debut, the Mormon films he made, and of course, his Tony nomination. But more importantly, there's a lot of listening, learning, and healing as we discuss some of the low points as well, like a show of his that only lasted a month on Broadway, the failure of that first marriage. But we start off our conversation about beginnings. While Will and I had been performing long before coming to New York, it was this move to the big city for each of us that truly began our search for something more from our careers. Well, Mr. Will Swenson, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's good to see you.
It couldn't be a bigger pleasure.
Right?
Patrick, my old buddy.
I know you and I go way back. So it's a pleasure to finally have you on the podcast and ask you all those questions that have just been eating away at me all these years.
Please. But we do go way back.
I know. Back. So I wanted to kind of start back because at this point you've been in 8 Broadway shows.
Sounds right.
But you didn't come to New York right away, like right out of college or anything. You lived and performed elsewhere, like we did at Disney World. So what was it that finally led you to pursue a career here in New York?
My wife and I got pregnant. We discovered that we were having a baby, and we had been kind of in a touring vein for a few years. And we were like, you know what? Touring doesn't seem like the most conducive thing to being stable parents. So we moved to New York and tried to put down some roots then.
Now, was that, I assume that was a transition, because like when we met, you were in Orlando, but you know, much different city than New York. Was it a transition?
Yeah, big time. I mean, that was always the plan, was to move to New York. I mean, I majored in theater and wanted to be a Broadway actor. But, you know, Disney World was the first big job that came a-calling. So I got my equity card at Disney World and got a couple of tours after that. And it seemed like the right time to head up to New York and try to dive into the big theater pond.
Yeah. Now your first show was Brooklyn. That was your first Broadway show here in New York.
Yeah.
And so at that point, did it feel like, okay, you wanted to get on Broadway? Did you feel like you'd made it? Or did it seem like maybe a stepping stone to something more?
Well, yeah. I mean, I always said when I was coming up, is like, if I can perform one night in one Broadway show, I will never be ungrateful afterward. I will just like, I will be able to check that off the list and be thrilled. And so on one hand, I was like, oh my gosh, I have performed on Broadway, even though I was a cover in a show that wasn't really hugely on the map. And I didn't go on a ton, but you change your goals immediately. The second you attain them, you're like, okay, well now I want this. And then the next one, you're like, oh, now I want this. And because it had taken so much work to get there, I moved to New York in 2000 and Brooklyn wasn't until 2004. So I spent 4 years of scrapping around and taking out of town stuff and off Broadway stuff.
Oh yeah.
Just trying to get seen. So I wasn't blind to the challenges of getting work.
And did you have to make a decision to stop doing the out of town stuff and just focus on in New York, or were you still trying to balance both?
No, I was just scrapping, trying to get on Broadway. I was, you know, I had a baby and my first wife and I were just like tag teaming parenting and I was dragging this baby around town auditioning and just trying to get it done. I mean, I come from a theater family back in Utah, and the safety net was at the time was always like, all right, well, if Will can't make it, then we'll just go back and take over the family theater someday. So there was sort of that in the back of my mind, was like, okay, well, I can always go home and kind of, you know, transition into taking over the theater as my mom wants to retire eventually.
Right. Now, your next Broadway show didn't last that very long. That would be Lestat. It only lasted a month on Broadway. What was that short experience like? I mean, was it a surprise that the show closed as early as it did?
It wasn't. And it's always funny to think of it as having such a short run, because from my experience and my memory, it was like, it was such a long process. Cause there was like the rehearsals and then the out of town in San Francisco, and then reworkshopping it because it wasn't working in San Francisco, and then coming back and trying to get it done. And I think we all knew that it just wasn't great kind of from the beginning. So
even in all these reworks and tweaks, it just never seemed to quite click.
Yeah. I mean, I remember having conversations with our castmates just going, it's like watching a slow motion train wreck. It's just like, oh no, that decision seems like it's never going to work and it's costing millions of dollars and it's too late to stop it. And oh no, it doesn't work and it's bad. And it seems like it should have. I mean, it was an Elton John score and based on the Anne Rice books, which are hugely popular. And I think we all thought that it was just going to be a slam dunk, but it was not.
Now, was it tough to then show up to work, or did everyone kind of keep the faith, keep believing, okay, maybe today they're going to fix it?
I mean, yeah, I think we thought it could catch on because I mean, you and I both know there are shows that are not great that have had long, healthy runs on Broadway.
They keep going, yeah.
Yeah, there are some that really, you know, structurally and musically maybe aren't the best things and they end up catching an audience. So we thought, you know, maybe it was an Elton John musical. We were just, you know, and I think he's written 4 or 5 and this is the only one that hasn't been a massive success.
Right.
And our cast was hugely talented, incredible voices and performances. So yeah, I think we thought that it could take off and, you know, everyone wants their show to do well. So we definitely gave it a college try.
and I'm curious, having not been in a Broadway show that failed or succeeded, once you're done with a short show like Lestat, everyone kind of knows, all right, well, that didn't work. Does that in any way affect either you auditioning as you go out or how people see you? I'm curious about that.
I don't know. You know, I don't know that there's ever too much judgment on the actors of a production that fail. Like, I feel like you can go to the worst show on Broadway ever and still be like, oh my God, those people are insanely talented. Like, the talent is always good.
Right.
There's so much talent, but I can't think of a show where I was like, well, that show failed because the performances were terrible. So I think like in the industry, maybe like we're lucky in that the blame doesn't get put on us. And generally, if something doesn't work, it's much more, you know, for other factors.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. True. And now your next show was one of those, 110 The Shade. It certainly did very, very well. It was received well. And that's also where you would end up meeting your future wife, Audra McDonald. Was there a connection right off the bat? Was it a slow process? How did that work?
It was super slow. We had kids the same age. So we started doing play dates with our kids and our kids got along really well. And, we were both married. So at first we didn't, you know, clock that there was something going on there, but you know, we were also in struggling marriages. And then, you know, way down the line, when our kids continued to get along and I started going on, I was an understudy for the lead role. And so when I got to go on, we had some fun chemistry on stage and things kind of, bubbled from there.
Right. It kind of laid the groundwork for what would come in the future.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. 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 Now, during these first three shows, you were also doing films and kind of once you moved to New York, you were doing films with LDS or the Mormon Church. How important has your faith, that church life that you grew up with, how important has that been to you in your life and career?
It's been wonderful and challenging at the same time. I no longer go to church. I'm not a practicing Mormon anymore. That said, you know, when you grow up Mormon, it's kind of the foundation of your being. You know, your entire culture is based around the church and a lot of expectation and a lot of, I guess just the whole structure of your world is kind of based in the church. So there's no getting around like the fact that I am Mormon in much that, you know, like if you were Jewish and you don't go to church anymore, you'd say I'm Jewish. So like, you know, I'm still very much culturally Mormon.
I don't know if it's the same for you. I grew up in the Presbyterian church. And even though I'm not regularly attending that church anymore, the principles, kind of the way of life that it was ingrained in me, that foundation as I was growing up, is still with me today. I may have departed here and there from this and that, but that core foundation is still kind of there in how I see the world.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I miss, you know, elements of it. And you know, it's a tricky thing to extricate yourself from. You know, I think there's the fear of judgment from close friends and family who think that you've, you know, gone morally astray if you no longer believe the way that they do. That's challenging. I come from a theater family, so I think on one hand, they're proud of their son of Utah that has done well and succeeded, and on the other hand, I think they're probably, you know, praying for me, and and frankly, I think they're sad and disappointed, and probably think that I have something wrong with my soul that I haven't stayed in the church, and that's sad.
Were those films like some of your last connection with the church?
Well, the films honestly weren't produced by the church itself. There was just right. This kind of era of making Mormon-centered material, kind of about Mormons for Mormons, but kind of, you know, they were like John Hughes movies for Mormons, but, you know, super, lots of inside jokes, and they did really well. There's a huge Mormon population in the world, and everyone wants to see themselves represented on screen. So these were just kind of the first of their kind, and they did really well. And because I was the star of the very first one, I think I was sort of recognizable. So I made a string of them, and they were great. They're cute little films, and I learned a ton about filmmaking, to the degree that I made my own one of them, wrote and directed one years after we started doing those.
Yeah, it must have laid the groundwork. I know for me, the commercials were kind of that getting on camera experience and learning just where to go, what to do, what these things mean as you're directed.
Yeah, right. All that technical craziness that goes into working in that medium. It's such a different animal from the theater.
Yeah, you've certainly done, at this point, more credits with when it comes to TV film than you have on Broadway. Would you say that you're now just as adept either way, or do you still feel at home in one more than the other?
Much more on stage. Having grown up on stage, that's my home, and that's my first love. I'm learning the craft of TV, particularly the last few years. I've out of necessity, since we haven't had the theater, right. I've been working kind of exclusively in film and TV for the last couple of years. So I just feel like that skill is so unique, and it's just technical. There's just so much to learn about how things get made and how to sort of clock the right ways to be. I mean, God, it's a conversation that's like three other podcasts for you, but I've said before, it's like math for actors. Just like,
Because there's so much technical. Yes, you still need to be talented and artistic, but there's so much technical blocking and choreography and where to put your hand and do this and make sure you're looking here, but don't talk loud enough, but soft enough.
Right. It's the ultimate multitaskers medium. Just like, if you can, you know, hit your mark and ignore this camera and this dude with the light right here, and make sure that you remember to touch this on this line every single time, and then look here on that time, but not there, but there. And it's a piece of tape on the camera you're looking at, not an actual actor. If you can do all that and still somehow drop into the dramatic moment that you're supposed to be portraying, then you're an amazing camera actor. But it's a challenge, and it's a long list of things to learn to try to get it right.
Well, going back to theater then, would you say that Hair was a defining moment in your career, particularly on stage and Broadway?
For sure. Absolutely. That was my big break, far and away. That was the moment that things started to finally roll. Like I had done three Broadway shows before that, but I was understudying in all of them. And like we were saying, you change your goals. You know, I got my first one and I was like, okay, well now I want to just be in the show. And so then in Lestat, I was in the show, but I was understudying for the leads, and then 110 in the Shade, the same story. And finally, at the end of 110, I told my agent, I was like, I don't want to understudy for my whole career. And I don't want to get known as a swing of somebody that can just come in and cover three or four roles well. I really want to be a leading man. So I stopped auditioning for ensemble roles, which was a
big tough decision there.
Yeah. Yeah. And Hair didn't even, it wasn't like Hair was going to be a Broadway show when I auditioned for it. It was just going to be a concert. It was going to be a 3-night concert at the Delacorte for the Public Theater. And I wasn't even going to get the lead at first. They offered it. I'm sure. I know they did. And to some, I don't know who it is to this day, but they offered it to some other, you know, probably recognizable name who turned it down. And then I was the, all right, well, let's give it to Will. So I just did the concert, and then that went really well. And they decided to bring it back to the Delacorte for one of their two summer shows the next summer. And then that went really well. And so then it went to Broadway. So it wasn't even like I auditioned for a Broadway show and got the lead. It was just one of the, you know, irons in the fire that took off. Thank goodness.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause Gavin Creel was with that from the concert all the way through the Broadway show, correct?
Actually, not true. The concert first was, Jonathan Groff.
That's right.
The concert and in the park, he was for most of it. And then he had to go shoot a movie, as one does when you're Jonathan Groff. And then Chris Hanke came in and played Claude for the rest of the summer, and he was awesome. And then on Broadway, it was Gavin.
So you were kind of the the anchor, and all these other guys are coming in around you.
A little bit, because Karen Olivo was actually our first Sheila. And then Karen Manuel was for the run in the park. And then Casey Levy played Sheila on Broadway. So I guess of the three of us, I was the only one that stuck around for the whole thing.
Was that just you saying, hey, I'll keep doing it? Or what?
Oh, I was desperate to keep doing it. I was like, this is an amazing part and an amazing show. It's just other people had other stuff to do. Karen Olivo, you know, went to do West Side Story and won a Tony Award. And I was like, Karen, you're nuts. Hair's going to be the biggest thing in the world. She's like, I'm going to go win a Tony. Shut up, Will.
Well, speaking of Tony, you got a nomination for Hair. Now, Yay! Did it feel like, hey, I'm giving a Tony Award winning performance, or was it a surprise? No, I mean, you know, that there is a sense of confidence that we have as actors, and we know if we're doing a good job.
It's impossible to answer that question. I have this mental block with the awards stuff. Like, I hate it. I hate it so much. The minute that like a show is successful, there are just 1,000 voices that get in your ear, and they're just like, "You're going to win it, Tony. This is amazing. You're so talented." And there's, it just gets in your head, and it's like this other entity in the room that, for my money, I just do not like. I wish they didn't exist. And simultaneously, I would love to win a Tony Award.
Yeah, right.
It's just, it's frustrating because you just want to do the show and you just want to like be in it as deeply as you can. And the minute that the award seasons come around, there's just this other voice in the room that's like challenging you to do well. And you want to show all your best stuff. And, you know, there's Tony voters out there. So everybody's giving it a little more than normal. And it's just, I hate that. I hate that. It's not just as pure as it could be. That sounds a little cheesy, but
no, but it sounds like you feel a different energy from a cast that knows they're up for an award. The show is nominated, or the individual performances are nominated. It just, something happens to the show is what.
Yeah. I mean, our art form is so much of it is about headspace. And when there's something else rattling around in that same headspace that isn't at its core part of the story, it's a detractor. And so I wish that awards season didn't exist. And if it did, I wish it was just like a lovely dinner with all of your peers and you know, and someone shouts out from the pulpit and just says, you guys were awesome. And you guys were awesome. Congratulations. Instead of it turning into this competitive thing. I mean, the last thing you want to do as an actor is feel competition with
right.
somebody
feel like you
else.
Need to beat another actor.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? The year that I was nominated, my fellow nominees, I was just like in awe of all of them. People that I grew up just going, are you kidding me? That's who I aspire to be. How could I possibly feel like I want to be in competition with these folks?
Yeah. I mean, because that year you were up against Mark Kudisch, Christopher Sieber, a couple of people from Billy Elliot, one of which was Gregory Jabara, who won. Now, certainly your wife knows a few things about the Tony Awards. How do you think that your views on the Tony Awards differ? I mean, obviously she's won and been nominated many times. Is there a little bit of perspective that she gives you?
I mean, she's in that luxurious position of saying they don't mean anything.
And I'm like, because she has
okay.
so many.
Yeah, they don't mean anything until you get one, and then you're much more castable, and you can ask for a lot more money.
Right.
I mean, they can mean a lot to the trajectory of a career, or how you're seen, or how you're marketed, blah blah blah. But I know what she means when she says they don't mean anything, because they shouldn't mean anything. That's another long whole podcast just to talk about how to deal with an incredibly talented partner in the business when you're on a different level. That's a podcast I would listen to over and over. And I have a lot of couple friends who are like, one of them is very successful and the other is you know,
a different not as successful,
a different kind of successful, and the challenges and insecurities that go along with that. But for the most part, I mean, that's a sexy problem to have, you know, oh, poor me. I have to deal with the mentality of my incredibly successful wife and, you know, 90% of any discussion that we have, I come out the luckier for her insight and her expertise.
I bet. I mean, because you've both been in the business about the same time, correct?
I mean, as far as professionally, she blew up so dang early. I mean, she graduated from Juilliard and, like, you know, got Carousel immediately. And that was in, like, what was that, like 96, I want to say?
Yeah, that was like mid-90s.
Yeah. I think so. When you and I were landing at Disney World, I think she was winning her first Tony Award. So
yes, yeah, that's
so, I mean, as far as getting our equity cards at the same time, maybe we've been in the same amount of time.
Right,
she's
right.
Been on a little different track.
I think that's one of the, it's both a beautiful thing, but also can be a frustrating thing when people are on different tracks. I mean, take you and I, for example. You know, we came along Disney World around the same time, and you showed up at New York a little bit before me, but there's been a similar trajectory. However, compared to me, you are the more successful one. You have achieved things that I'm still waiting on. And so there is beauty in the fact that we can all make it in different ways in this career, mm-hmm. but frustrating when looking at other people who uh-huh. are what you aspire to be, you know, like the people that were also nominated with you when you were nominated for a Tony. How do you deal with that kind of frustration of seeing others who are doing what you want to do?
Well, I'll tell you what, and it's taken me a long time to get to this point, and I hopefully I'm still getting to this point, but in life, I feel like the things that I value the most are the things that I've had to work the hardest at. And I am super grateful for the challenges that I faced getting to this point. I think if I had landed in New York and, like, you know, hit the ground running and was massively successful right off the bat, I don't think I'd value it as much. So I'm grateful for the scrapping that I've had to do. And I think it's made my if you want to call it success, feel a little sweeter, in that, it's taken a long time to get here. And as I know is the case with you as well, when your personal life is this other sort of, beast to wrangle at the same time, sometimes you just gotta, you know, give your energy to that and try to stay afloat in life and your aspirations for a successful acting career. You know, you have to press pause on that in order to get a hold of yourself. Our lives have both taken some pretty crazy left turns that we maybe didn't foresee when we started out. Yeah. And if we had, you know, made it all about the business and nothing but the business, we probably wouldn't be here. we probably would have had to make other life choices that wouldn't have led us to where we are. And I don't think I would be I hope I'm well adjusted, but I don't think I'd be as well adjusted.
we all hope that we're getting there.
But hopefully you choose your sanity and your happiness first when it comes to the trajectory of how you navigate this.
Yeah.
This life and not just the business.
Yeah, because we've both been married before, and it was actually during our first marriages that you and I met and got to know each other in Orlando while at Disney World. And I remember the struggles that I went through after my marriage ended. It took me a while to kind of adjust to that new chapter in my life. And mm-hmm. you know, and as you said, it affected me both personally as well as professionally. What was it that helped you through that tough transition kind of back to single life again?
Man, that's a big question. I mean, the big answer is Audra helped me. But at the same time, I had to figure out who I was. It felt like from scratch when I left the church and got divorced. You know, like I said earlier, growing up in the Mormon church, it's everything about who you are. And so stepping away from that was, you know, it was a years long process of getting the strength to kind of say, you know what, this doesn't work for me. And I can't make it true. I've tried my whole life and I can't make it true anymore. And I've tried every single thing that I can do.
Did it feel like you were letting yourself down in some way?
Absolutely. You know, and I felt like there was something wrong with me, you know, morally, and I've always tried to live the best life that I can. I'm far from perfect. And, you know, and it would force me to like focus on my shortcomings as a person and just beat myself up to no end. And it was detrimental to my confidence in my soul, just kind of feeling like I was this terrible, unworthy person because I couldn't make this church true for myself.
I know that for myself, when my marriage ended, I know I lost a part of myself. And I know that there was a part of me that I either didn't know or had just had to change because I'm now in a different place in my life. Mm-hmm. So I know for me, there was just a part of me that got cut off. Some of my own doing, some of her doing, some of just the way that it happened. And it took me years, as you said, to rediscover, to figure out, wait, well, what am I doing? How do I get myself back?
Absolutely. You know, finally, after literally more than a decade of just praying as hard as I could and trying to make it work and that having its ramifications on my relationship, being massively challenging. I was like, I've tried every single thing that I could other than stepping away. So I did that. And that was, you know, also a long, long process. And a gut-wrenching process. And because, you know, it's everything that you've known and believed in, it felt very much like a rebirth of like creating a person, a new person. I mean, when I look back on my life, it seems like, you know, there's that will, and then there's this other life. So to answer your question, it took soul searching. It feels like courage to let my family down in quotation marks and leave the church. It broke my family's heart and still does. I think, the vast, vast majority of my family are still very, very fervent in the church. And it's continued to, you know, be a point of friction to this day. It's hard to walk around, you know, feeling like you've let your family down. You know, to that end, to be fair, my family are incredibly lovely. And I, you know, I've been very lucky. I've had other Mormon friends who have left the church and have had much trickier, more devastating reactions from their families. So at any rate, there was this sort of just having to sort of rediscover who I was and what I, yeah, you know, literally at age around 30s when I started to leave the church, a little before that, I was having to ask myself questions like, what do I believe in? Do I believe in God? Because I feel like I've been sort of spoon fed all of this my whole life. And it's very much a culture of believing like everybody else believes and, you know, sure, I believe that because everyone around me believes that. Sure, grandma and grandpa believe that, so I do too. You know, and you sort of live on this borrowed light growing up, and to step away from that and go, oh, I don't have any light of my own at this moment. Where's my light? It was challenging, and so the challenge was to continue to find and try to find spirituality and structure and a moral center without the structure of the church to spoon feed that to me and raise kids, you know, who are good people and teach them the same beautiful, you know, precepts of morality and goodness that I was taught growing up in the church. So it was a whole process of sort of recreating myself. But I don't think it's a coincidence that at the moment that I took that leap and started to discover my true, what I want to say, of my true light, my career took off at the exact same moment. Because I feel like our medium is like our biggest currency is authenticity. And if you can be the most authentic, most true version of your role, yourself, if you can bring as much honesty as you possibly can to your performance, if what you're showing is as close to truth as you possibly can, that's undeniable. And so I feel like there was a veil over my performance and my world for a long time. And I feel like once I had to ask myself the hard questions of who I really was and what I believed, and was able to sort of, you know, emerge from the cocoon, so to speak, I don't think it's a coincidence that my work started to take off.
Those basic fundamental questions of who am I? What do I want out of this life? These get to the very heart and core of who we are, not only as artists, but as human individuals as well. It's been a journey that I am still on to this day, and the longer I keep looking, then the more clues I find. I mean, as the old saying goes, it's not the destination, it's the journey, right? And this certainly applies to the constant evolution and redefining of ourselves that we experience throughout the many stages and chapters of our lives. So make sure to join me for the second half of my conversation with Will, where we talk even more about his experiences in the musical Hair, as well as the state of theater in 2021. And there are actually a couple of ways to catch part two of our conversation. You can certainly wait for the next episode to come out through the podcast feed, or become a monthly supporter of Why I'll Never Make It to watch both parts one and two, which are already available on YouTube. Go to join.whyillnevermakeit.com for all the details on how you can donate and support this podcast. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Publicity provided by Imagine PR Group. Music in this episode by Bortex. Why I'll Never Make It is a part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.